Support for Modern Love comes from Living Proof. How long can you...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
So between washes, keep your hair cleaner longer while washing less for beautiful, healthier hair. Use the code LOVE at livingproof.com for a free travel-size dry shampoo with your $20 order. We are the science. You are the living proof. And by the Golden Globe-winning Showtime series, The Affair. Betrayal is only the beginning of an irresistible web of danger and deceit in this gripping psychological thriller. New episodes of The Affair every Sunday at 10 p.m. Download the Showtime app now to start your free trial.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Imagine if your spouse suddenly became a different person, if the words they said made them seem like a total stranger. Mark Lukacs has been there and back. Filmmaker and actor Mark Duplass reads for us this week. You may know him from his roles in HBO's Togetherness and the new film Blue Jay. Mark Duplass reads Mark Lukacs' essay, Out of the Darkness.
There was a time when my wife Julia said yes to almost everything I suggested. But before she consented, there was always an unnatural pause, a pause so small it may have gone unnoticed by others. But it was painfully obvious to me. That pause did not come from her. It came from the antipsychotic medication she had to take. Years ago, when Julia and I were 27 and in our third year of marriage, she suffered a psychotic break. She had no history of mental illness preceding the abrupt arrival of delusions and paranoia. It was a bewildering decline that snowballed from typical work stress to mild depression, to sleeplessness, to voices speaking to her in the night. The medicine combated the psychosis by slowing everything down. Her metabolism, movements, and response time. I didn't like what the medicine did to her, but I liked even less what her unmedicated self was like and capable of doing. So I gave her the medicine. I observed her as she took it, making sure she did not hide it in her mouth and spit it out later. She still managed to do that a few times anyway. To try to make sense of why she had to live in this medicated haze, I thought of her condition as being like an old television. The type where you have to turn the dial to change the channels. For some reason, Julia had become stuck between channels, so all that was broadcasting in her mind was crackly white noise, and it drove her mad, right into the halls of a psychiatric ward. The medicine was like turning down the volume. It was what had to be done until the channels could work again, and while the volume was turned down, her entire life was on mute. She wasn't psychotic. She wasn't delusional. She just kind of wasn't. She didn't communicate much when she was on the medicine, and when she did, it was mostly just yes or no. More often than not, it was yes, because I think she wanted to make me happy. I mean, if we had to go through this hell, at least she wanted to be agreeable. During this time, I thought of her as the great validator. The fact that she did not speak much also meant that I spoke a lot, about silly things, things that filled the silence so that I could try to keep her mind here with me and not adrift in her illness. But occasionally, she spoke on her own, without prompting, and beyond yes or no. Those rare moments of self-initiated conversation were always about one of two subjects: suicide or love. the suicide conversations were never fun. They happened over and over, out of nowhere, in the midst of one of our agreed-upon dog walks, or while washing the dishes, or whatever. Often, as I talked about something insignificant, Julia would interrupt and say, "Mark, if someone kills themselves, do they still get a funeral?" "What do you mean?" "Well, I know that if you kill yourself, you go to hell, but does that mean they don't let you have a funeral? Do you still get a funeral if you're going to hell?" "We don't have to think about that, Julia, because you're not going to kill yourself." "Maybe," she said. "No maybe about it. We'll see." And she'd smile. Thoughts of suicide tended to make her smile, like she was a little child being told, "You can have your ice cream later." It was something to look forward to. When suicidal thoughts made her happy, I knew it was my cue to remind her of other reasons to feel happy. So I told her I loved her, and that so many other people loved her too, that she was so strong for holding on, that none of this was her fault, that the feelings would go away, that she just had to keep holding on. These suicidal conversations could be quick or they could be slow. One time we were biking to yoga together, and we had to pull over and sit on the sidewalk for almost 2 hours while she sobbed and begged me to let her kill herself. I pleaded with her to just hang on through this moment, and that it would pass, and that she would someday, somehow, start to feel better again. When the suicidal feelings gripped her tightly, her whole body groaned and wailed over the loss of control of mind and feelings. I would hold her, but I learned that all I could do in those moments was to sit there and let it be. So I did. And then the fog would clear, the suicidal impulses would slip back under the surface, and the muted, agreeable Julia would return. "Are you okay now, honey?" "Yes." "Do you know how proud of you I am and how much I love you?" "Yes." "Are you ready to get back on the bike and go home?" "Yes." In our conversations about love, which always would arise unprompted, Julia would interrupt whatever we were doing to tell me how much she loved me. Instead of questions like, "Why would God do this to me?" or, "Can you agree to let me kill myself in 1 year if this doesn't get better?" my lovely, broken, medicated wife would take my hand, look me in the eyes, and say, "Mark, you are the most wonderful person I know. Thank you for helping to save my life. I love you, and I'm staying alive because of you." Just like that. As her spouse and caregiver, one of my biggest struggles was to keep my own emotions in check. She was too fragile to witness how much her delusions, paranoia, and depression scared and worried me. So I had to pretend that none of it bothered me. I became a master at compartmentalizing my worry and anxiety, neatly packaging my feelings into the small, permissible moments when I had the time and space, away from Julia. For the most part, though, I was her cheerleader, and nothing, no matter how dark or despairing, could shake me. Except when she told me she loved me. But when she told me she loved me, that I was saving her life, and that she was staying alive, not for herself, but for me, those moments always left me stunned, teary-eyed, and breathless. I had no defense against those. They left me reaching to her to find my stability rather than the other way around. How can you shield yourself from the impact of someone saying, "I love you," And why would you? Julia has since gotten better. She no longer takes the medicine. We don't live in a yes or no existence anymore. We now live with bills and iPhones and deadlines. I'm glad to have left behind the anxiety and unknowns of dealing with a serious mental illness. It was a grueling year for both of us. And yet, when I look back on that year, I have to admit there is a part of me that misses it, or more accurately, a part of it that I miss. I don't miss the illness itself, of course. We're still not sure where the darkness came from, or why it's behind us, or even what the actual diagnosis was. Psychotic depression, maybe? All I know is that it was exhausting to deal with on a daily basis, and so I am glad it is gone. And I don't miss Julia's sadness, a sadness that seemed to be without limits. Good riddance to that. But I do miss how much we talked about life and love that year. It seemed like all we ever talked about. In one sense, we have never communicated less in our relationship and never been in such different mental spaces. Yet in another sense, we were closer emotionally than we have ever been and more deeply connected. Her mental illness casts such a strange web of paradoxes into our life together. Nowadays, we bicker about things like doing the dishes. One of us will say, "I cooked dinner, so you can wash the dishes." And the other will respond, "Well, I did the laundry today and folded it and put it away, so no. But I walked the dog by myself tonight, but I made the bed," until finally one of us, you know, does the dishes. When Julia was sick, we did the dishes together because there was nothing else to do. As long as we were together, we could agreeably wait out the disease and show it that we were more patient than it was. I think that's what I miss. We weren't in a rush to do anything else because there was no certainty of a future. So we defaulted to living in the present, focusing on each moment of our yes and no days. A time when only two things matter to us.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building, find an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Life and love.
Mark Duplass reading Mark Lukacs' essay, Out of the Darkness. A lot has happened to Julia and Mark since he wrote this essay. We'll hear from him after the break.
Living Proof products make life easier. Just ask Aaron from LA.
I go to hot yoga, and because of Living Proof's dry shampoo, I don't actually have to wash my hair after hot yoga. I mean, I still body shower. It's not like totally gross, but I can go to work and no one will even notice because the dry shampoo is so amazing.
Use the code LOVE at livingproof.com for a free travel size dry shampoo with your $20 order.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. When his wife Julia was first hospitalized, Mark Lukacs wrote long essay-like emails to his parents and his in-laws. He would do this in the hospital and send them out every evening. It was cathartic, but it was also a window into an undiscovered passion. He says writing continues to help him navigate what has become a challenging few years.
When I published the essay, Julie and I were under the hope and understanding that her psychotic episode was going to be a one-time thing. And that's really what her doctors were hoping, and certainly we were sort of acting under that assumption. And unfortunately, as it turns out, it was not. She's had, since the essay came out, she's been hospitalized two more times. Knowing that she had a second episode, we basically got an updated diagnosis from her doctor. It went from this one-time thing to instead, no, you have bipolar, which is going to be something that's probably going to be a part of your life forever, and you may have continually recurring episodes. And so that really forced Julie and I to reconsider how we approach this, not only how we approached each other as a couple, but how we approached this new piece of our relationship, which was this diagnosis that might upend our lives every now and then.
It was during this challenging time, and after serious deliberation with doctors and with each other, Mark and Julia decided to have a child. Their son Jonas is now 4 years old.
He was 6 months old when Julia had her second episode, and then 2.5 years old when she had her third episode. And so when we factor in parenting into all this as well, it really made it all the more important that we had to have what felt like a plan for if she's getting sleepless, if she's showing some of these signs of the early onsets of psychosis, what can we do about it in order to keep Julia healthy, to respect her sense of autonomy, but also to like make the situation not too stressful for me. And then, of course, to make sure our son feels loved and safe and not scared by all this.
Remarkably, Jonas has coped well with these changes.
I think about what he's gone through, and he somehow seems to be almost like he moved through it immune to its consequences. Now, I don't know long-term what this is going to mean. We don't know if Julie's ever going to end up back in the hospital again. Jonas is a lot more aware now, but I do really have to say that given how much of an emotional toll this has taken on me, he seems to have been able to manage it pretty well.
But does Mark ever worry about Jonas's mental health?
I think about if Jonas is going to have something like this all the time, actually. I remember when he got his first vaccine shots when he was 6 weeks old, and he couldn't sleep that night because he was fussy from the shots. And I was holding him, and he was crying, and I sobbed the entire time while I was trying to comfort him. And it was because that's where it really hit me of what life means. When you bring a life into the world, you're setting them up for so much beauty, but so much pain and so much suffering. And we don't know what that's going to look like. And it just hit me so hard that he might be on a similar path that Julie's been on. He might be manic or psychotic or suffer with depression or any of these things. And I don't know. My only hope is that if he does, at least we can learn from Julia's and my experience as we try to figure out how to manage it. Instead, we can feel more empowered and more empathetic and more informed.
This conversation was full of difficult questions, including whether Mark had ever contemplated giving up on this marriage.
I was 27 at the time, and my boss looked at me and he said, "If this happened to me when I was your age, I would be out of here." And I've thought about that a lot, and I got to be honest with you, I haven't actually really thought about leaving. I've certainly gotten very frustrated. And I know Julia has gotten really frustrated. Like that frustration's a two-way street for us. But I come from a family that believes in family. I've seen my relatives and my siblings, and we've all sort of managed to persevere through challenges and insist that we are not going to give up on family. And I fell in love with Julia for many reasons. I chose to marry her for many reasons. And that is probably the most important promise that I'll ever make to anyone, ever, is to say, I'm going to be with you forever. And for her to say back to me, I'm going to be with you forever too.
So Julia has had a great year and is thriving at work. Mark continues to write about his experience.
Look, the stats around mental illness are pretty clear that there's a lot of people who have a diagnosed mental illness. And all those people have families. And so those families are also impacted. And so you've got a huge, huge population who has this experience that shaped them that not many people are talking about. Like, I've gotten emails that's...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing?
It's actually a really complicated question.
To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building, finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Hey, I'm on my phone in the waiting room, and I started Googling, and I found your article. And I think those are the ones that hit me the hardest, because I know exactly what that person is feeling like. They're so scared. They have no idea what's happening. And they need someone to kind of give them a pat on the arm and say, look, I don't know what's going to happen for you, but I can at least tell you what happened for me, and maybe you can learn from it a little bit.
Mark Lukacs, the writer of this week's essay. Mark's memoir, My Lovely Wife in the Psych Ward, will be out in May of 2017. More from Mark Duplass and Daniel Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times, in a minute.
Support for Modern Love comes from the Showtime original series, The Affair. No one could have predicted the effects of betrayal would be so far-reaching and shatter so many lives. But the past cannot be undone, and the consequences continue to mount. So who can you trust when no two versions of the story are alike and the truth itself is unreliable? Find out on The Affair, starring Dominic West, Ruth Wilson, Maura Tierney, and Joshua Jackson. Download the Showtime app now to start your free trial and catch up on The Affair. New episodes every Sunday at 10 p.m.
Welcome back. When Dan Jones read this piece for the first time, he was struck by the extreme challenges facing this young couple.
The twist in this piece is how our relationships can just be so routine and superficial, and you don't appreciate each other, and you don't talk about things that are meaningful, and life comes down to those kinds of, you know, little bitter, resentful exchanges. And because of this, you know, hobbled state their relationship was in, love and life and appreciation were the only things they talked about. It's sometimes a test is what brings out the best in you, and that's certainly the case with Mark. You know, often I admire the writers of these essays, not only for being able to write about something and being brave enough to write about it, but for the behavior in the essay, you know, for what they are able to do. I would not be able to have the backbone that so many of these people have in difficult situations. It gives me faith in humanity.
Dan Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times. Thanks again to filmmaker Mark Duplass for reading this week's essay.
I've dealt a lot with mental illness personally in my family, with my friends. I happen to be in a group of really sensitive, depressive artists, and we deal with this stuff all the time. And our goals are to transcend, but we also realize there's immense value in it. So To look at mental illness as a way of making lemonade out of lemons is really difficult, but it's a beautiful venture if you're brave enough to embark upon it.
Mark Duplass. His latest project is Blue Jay, a film in which he stars opposite Sarah Paulson. It's in theaters now and will be on Netflix in December. Next week on Modern Love, Molly Ringwald on taking a vacation with your ex.
The mother and father do not fight over the laundry. They do not fight over money. They do not fight over their marriage. There is no laundry or money or marriage to fight over. Not anymore.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, and Amory Sievertson. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Our casting consultant is Amy Lippins, CSA. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.